Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist with The Wall Street Journal, Julia Ongwin, who has uncovered a new government surveillance regime at the National Counterterrorism Center that was resisted by privacy rights officials in the Department of Homeland Security before being put in place last March by John Brennan, President Obama's nominee to head up the CIA. We will discuss this new program described as a sea change in the government's ability to collect data on its citizens. Julia has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. Then we'll examine the brazen actions of the Virginia legislature, where Senate Republicans passed a radical redistricting plan while a key Democrat was attending the presidential inauguration. Keisha Gaskins, a voting rights advocate and senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program, joins us to discuss the latest gerrymandering in a key swing state and whether the Republicans, who are on the losing end of changing demographics, plan to stay competitive by rigging the vote. Then finally, we'll be joined by Joel Castex, who is a spokesperson for SNAP, the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests. She will address the just-released records the Archdiocese of Los Angeles have fought for years to keep secret that reveal Cardinal Roger Mahoney hid sex abuse cases from authorities. We will discuss the now-retired Cardinal's contrition in the face of more and continuing evidence of a systemic cover-up of abuse by pedophile priests in the Catholic Church. And joining us now is Julia Ongwin, who is an award-winning investigative journalist at The Wall Street Journal. She's the author of Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. In 2003, she was on a team of reporters at The Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. And in 2010, she led a team of reporters that chronicled the decline of online privacy in a series of articles titled What They Know that won the Gerald Loeb Award. She has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julia Ongwin.
Happy to be here.
And through the Wall Street Journal, you've gotten freedom of information requests and interviews with a number of senior officials. And let's go back to that meeting in the White House Situation Room last March. I guess it was chaired by John Brennan, the counterterrorism chief, who is now the nominee for the Central Intelligence Agency. What went on in that meeting?
So in that meeting, top officials from the intelligence agencies got together to discuss a new program they were putting together that would allow people in the U.S. to be surveilled even if they were not suspected of a crime, that their records, which were stored in government agencies, could be collected by the National Counterterrorism Center and analyzed for clues to see if they might be terrorists. And this was a big change because previously the intelligence community had operated under a code where if you're going to look at U.S. citizens and track them, you have to have a good reason to do so. And now they were deciding to switch the burden of proof, so now it was innocent people being, you know, who were being surveilled and actually having to prove that they were not terrorists.
So I take it that this new regime, in effect, according to one of the critics who resisted this change within the government, saying that the first thing the government will want to know about you is are you a terrorist?
Right. This woman, Mary Ellen Callahan, who was at the time the chief privacy officer at the Department of Homeland Security, was the one arguing in this meeting that this was going to be a sea change in the way the government interacts with the public. And the sea change she was talking about is that previously, if you had an interaction with the government, say you file your taxes or you go to a Veterans Administration hospital or whatever it is that you do that relates to the government, you don't have an expectation that you're being analyzed to see if that transaction you conducted with the government actually is a sign that you're a terrorist. And this program would actually change that equation so that you would sort of have to expect that you're being analyzed during those moments. And she was arguing that that was something that they should really be cautious about, because that really changes the whole relationship between citizens and the government.
So given that John Brennan was chairing this meeting without sort of inventing a dialogue, but trying to sort of put oneself in this meeting, I take it that what he's arguing is that the system failed at the time of the underwear bomber, who turned out he wasn't in the existing system that they had. That was Christmas Day of 2009. And apparently what the counterterrorism people in the government felt after that was that this was not a failure to collect or share intelligence. It was a failure to connect and integrate and understand the intelligence we had. That's actually quoting John Brennan.
Right. That was his quote at the press conference when, after the underwear bomber mishap, you know, where they hadn't characterized him correctly and hadn't put him on the watch list. The government did a sort of a self-examination, like what went wrong. And what went wrong in the underwear bomber case was that they actually had intelligence that he was a suspected terrorist, but he hadn't been placed on the watch list, mostly because of sort of, you know, just simple mistakes. So there were some people who, like, his name was misspelled maybe in some records or in some of the queries, and hadn't put all the pieces of data that were in various government repositories weren't pulled together into the National Counterterrorism Center's analysis the way that they should have. It's worth just pointing out, the National Counterterrorism Center is a new agency, was just created in 2004 for the sole purpose of connecting these types of dots.
Well, I recall, though, at the time of the underwear bomber, in the recriminations that followed, that the CIA was informed via the Nigerian embassy, I believe, that the underwear bomber's own father said that his son was dangerous.
Yes. So what happened was there was a lot of information in the various government locations that would have, should have led, right, for him to be put on the watch list, and that was a failure. Now, the question really that was being debated in the Situation Room was, what was the right way to address that failure? So the people who are arguing for this change were saying, look, you know, it was too hard for us to go to each agency and go to the CIA and say, look up everything you have about Abdul Muttalib, and maybe they ran the query wrong or they spelled it wrong or they didn't get the right data, and then go to another agency and say, give us everything you have on Abdul Muttalib. Because that's the traditional way that this type of connecting the dots works. You have to go to somebody and say, I have a suspect, give me everything you have about that suspect. They were saying, look, this method hasn't worked. What we need is all the data in-house, so we can have computers just run and match all this stuff very easily. You know, in their mind, it was really a technical issue. If all the data is there, then computers can do the matching. It eliminates the possibility of human error. And that all may be very true. But the people arguing against the change were saying, look, in fact, you knew he was a suspect. And so this wasn't a failure of our policies of only looking at data about people who are suspects. So no need to pull in every single person's data and make them sort of de facto a suspect if they're really innocent. And so this was a philosophical debate, and some of it is about technology. Is technology the solution here in the sense that maybe computers will do this matching better and no one will be harmed, or maybe computers are going to make us all into suspects?
Again, I'm speaking with Julia Angwin, who is an award-winning investigative journalist at the Wall Street Journal. She's the author of Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America, and she received the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on corporate corruption, and in 2010 led a team that chronicled the decline of online privacy in a series of articles titled What They Know. She has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. Now, so let's go back to the genesis of what the government has done, and in terms of keeping files on its citizens, particularly in the post-9/11 era. Shortly after 9/11, there was quite a flap over Admiral Poindexter's proposal, the Total Information Awareness Database, that had sort of ubiquitous trolling of information, that was shot down. So how much is this the nose of the camel of total information awareness?
You know, total information awareness was this idea, actually. It was never put in action, that Admiral Poindexter had after 9/11. And his concept, which was really just a concept, was to get all data, credit card transactions, commercial data from around the country, and match it with all the government's data about citizens, airline trips, et cetera, and put them all in one giant database, which, you know, the idea was if you knew basically every single data point about every citizen, you would be able to find the terrorists. And he ran into a huge amount of trouble. You know, Congress defunded the program. He had to retire. And it was roundly criticized. Now, the program now, the National Counterterrorism Center, is not as broad in the sense that they're only talking about government data. They're not talking about all the commercial data, credit card transactions, and all your relationships with internet services, and et cetera. However, it does actually talk about every single bit of data you have within the government. Theoretically, under these new rules, the Counterterrorism Center does have access to all of those, all the data in the government that is about you. So it is a piece of what was envisioned in TIA, but not the whole piece.
So tell us about, Julia Angwin, the TIDE database that the Counterterrorism Center has already. It's got, 500,000, the National Counterterrorism Center, I should say. It has, 500,000 entries or identities?
That's the estimate. They're not disclosing, but I think the last time that there was a number disclosed to Congress, it was about 500,000 people on the watch list, this TIDE watch list. The TIDE list is a list of people who are either suspected terrorists or friends of terrorists or possibly just related to terrorists in a loose way. And so it's a list of people basically that the Counterterrorism Center wants to keep an eye on. Now, that list is actually what the FBI uses to create the real watch list, which is a much smaller list, and that's what sort of contributes to the no-fly list. So those are people with whom they actually have very strong suspicion. So it's a much smaller set. So basically, the way you get on a watch list is first you get into this TIDE, this larger watch list of sort of people with suspicious friends or suspicious behavior, and then if there's enough of a reason, you end up on this like very specific watch list that can prohibit certain types of activities.
But that's been proven to be inaccurate, has it not? I recall Senator Edward Kennedy, the late Senator Kennedy, was stopped, prevented from getting on a plane, and there have been some somewhat comical examples, have there not?
There have. I mean, the problem with the watch list is it's gone, you know, I think right after 9/11, it got very restrictive, and there were a lot of absurd examples, like, you know, the Senator Kennedy example of people being prohibited from flying. Then they tried to loosen it up, and then, of course, you know, you had the underwear bomber who probably should have been on it. So it's a constant struggle to get these watch lists correct. You know, and there's a lot of evidence that we see of the incorrect moments. Of course, the people in the intelligence community will tell you, oh, but you don't see the success stories. Those are the ones that you never hear about. And, you know, we have to sort of take that on faith.
So tell us then, Julia Angwin, about how this new National Counterterrorism Center list is going to operate. It apparently can keep data about innocent U.S. citizens for up to 5 years using predictive pattern matching to analyze suspicious patterns of behavior.
Right. So as I mentioned before, the previous way that people were, you know, analyzed at the center were that some tip had come in. So, you know, underwear bomber's dad says my son is a terrorist. You know, that would be enough of a tip to then have them go pull the files. Now, the way they have the authority to basically run patterns through the database. So let's say they get an entire database from everybody who's ever flown to a certain country, and they decide that everyone on there might be possibly a terrorist if they meet certain conditions, meaning they wore pink that day and they had frizzy hair. I'm making this up, but my point is they could come up with some patterns, and they've gotten the authority to run those types of patterns on these large data sets and then investigate whether those people are terrorists. And this really just changes the equation, because previously you as a citizen or me as a citizen had this feeling that, you know, I'm probably not going to end up in their crosshairs because I'm not a terrorist and I'm not friends with any terrorists. But now there's this element of thinking, wow, you know, and you don't know what the criteria is, and you could be sort of caught in this dragnet at any time.
And apparently these databases can be shared with foreign governments. Lists and data on U.S. civilians can be handed over to foreign governments for analysis.
Yeah, this is one of the more amazing things of the new guidelines. So the authority that they got under the new guidelines that were issued in March actually does allow these databases to be shared in their entirety with foreign governments. Obviously, you know, people in the intelligence community say, look, we're not going to do that willy-nilly, and it would be under certain conditions. But the fact is that they do have an incredible authority there to share this data, so it explicitly says to help them analyze it for clues about terrorism. So not only would, theoretically, the National Counterterrorism Center be looking for people flying to a certain country with pink frizzy hair, but also other governments could add their own criteria, in theory.
So again, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Wall Street Journal, Julia Angwin, who has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. Tell us about the dissent within the government, particularly at Homeland Security. And it would seem that the main dissenters lost the battle. There's no question about that. But they also left government, did they not?
Yeah, although I would say that the dissenters, it seems from my reporting, left government in a planned way. They were, you know, the change of, you know, most people kind of do one term of service and maybe they were coming to the end of it. However, it is true that the department, there were two people at the Department of Homeland Security, the head of the privacy office there and the head of the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, who were very concerned about this change. And there was also somebody at the Department of Justice, the chief privacy officer there, who raised concerns. And they were, you know, they did lose the fight, although some people would say that they probably softened some of it or got some concessions in this new guidelines. But the fact is that I think it's kind of telling that the Department of Homeland Security, these are the privacy officers there, is the ones who approved full body scanners, right? So these are not people who are on the far left of the privacy fight, right? They're fully okay with taking pictures of us nude. But even they thought that this went too far. And to me, that was kind of a compelling argument why it was worth writing about, because it seemed to me that even people who were very much committed to the terrorism fight were saying, look, this crosses a line that we shouldn't be crossing.
Well, it seems, I mean, one of the quotes in your article, Julia Angwin, one of your sources is a senior administration official familiar with the White House debate saying that this program is breathtaking in its scope. Now, I recall in the Bush administration, there was an incident when the attorney general was in a hospital and was very ill, and he had transferred his powers to the deputy attorney general, who had raced to the hospital room along with the head of the FBI to stop the White House chief of staff and White House counsel, Gonzalez, from getting the attorney general to renew a surveillance regime, as far as we know, that the head of the FBI and the deputy attorney general wanted to stop. And they thought that they were doing this in a kind of underhand and stealth way. So we've never found out what that regime was that those two senior officials went to such lengths to stop.
Mm-hmm. That story is still, we're still waiting to hear the end of that, right? I mean, everybody has heard this dramatic story, but we're still waiting to find out what was the scope of that program that was, you know, described as wireless wiretapping, exactly how many of our conversations and emails were being wiretapped.
So just give us a sense then, Julia, of how this extra government surveillance is happening in the context of the broader issue. You mentioned commercial data mining. It's pretty ubiquitous, isn't it? I mean, I noticed, you know, Google seems to know a lot about you, keeps recommending stuff all the time. And we, the younger generation on Facebook, and of course, you've clearly written about this in your articles at the Wall Street Journal, what they know. The younger generation seem to be quite happy to post all kinds of details about their private lives. So privacy itself seems to be under assault, both in the commercial realm and in the government realm. Are those two engines likely to get together? Or perhaps they have.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that a lot of people think of government surveillance and commercial surveillance as separate, but in fact, they're very much related. So one, and the main reason that they're related is because of our outdated laws governing privacy. So the Fourth Amendment is really the amendment that, of the Constitution that is most concerned with privacy in the sense that it says you can't have a search of somebody's home or their person's papers or effects without probable cause. And that has been sort of the standard bearer for privacy in the sense of limiting government intrusion on our lives without cause. The problem is that the courts have interpreted the Fourth Amendment to basically not cover anything not stored in your house. And these days, our digital lives are stored all over the place, right? Our data is stored with Google or with Facebook, and the government has a lot of data about us, and so it's not in our house. And the law still sort of takes a very physical approach to search. So it protects information in your house, but not the information that's in the government files or in Google's files. And so that means that basically the government doesn't have to show probable cause when it's searching your email, right? Or in your cell phone location records. We've written a lot about both of those cases where there's a lot of people who feel like this isn't a fair rule and it should be updated. In fact, most of the tech companies, Google, Apple, have joined a coalition asking for those laws to be updated. But so we're in a legal regime that just hasn't caught up with the technology, and that means that a lot of our data is up for grabs, not just the government data or just the commercial data, but all of it.
Well, just in closing, Julia Angwin, who has the upper hand here? I'm reminded of one of the founding fathers, Ben Frankman's admonition that he who would trade liberty for temporary security deserves neither. In terms of the array of, and your article makes it pretty clear that those on the privacy side lost this bureaucratic battle in the White House. But those on the other side, of course, John Brennan is now nominated to be head of the CIA. Eric Holder is leaving Justice, but I'm not sure that he was ever that zealous in that in terms of protecting privacy. How would you see the array of pro and con privacy in the administration? And after all, it was the president himself who apparently demanded that the government clean up its database after the aborted underwear bomber.
Well, the thing is that privacy is one of those things that's very difficult for politicians to be for. I mean, they can be for it in the abstract, but when you are, it's so easy to say, I want to be tough on terrorism. That's a winning strategy, right? And so it's the so far, all of these battles, the Patriot Act, the warrantless wiretapping, you know, all of these battles have been lost by the privacy people because they can't show dead bodies on the ground. And, you know, that may be the right solution. Maybe we don't care as much about privacy as a society as we do about terrorism. But I think that what's happening is as people become more aware of what's happening, privacy is becoming a more important topic. You can certainly see it in sort of popular culture. People talk about it more. People change their Facebook setting, privacy settings more than they ever did before. So I think that there may be a changing public sentiment, but it has not yet reached the government. That tide of change has not yet reached the government enough that they want to do anything to change their behavior.
So what are we left with? The public getting sufficiently outraged?
I think so. I mean, it's actually, if you don't mind me promoting, I'm writing a book right now on this exact question, which is it possible to really promote, to do anything to protect your privacy, you individually, or does it require is it beyond the scope of any sort of individual? And so I've been doing a lot of things to try to protect my privacy, and I'm finding it's extremely difficult, and it's basically a full-time job. But I'm hoping that readers will learn from my experience that it's not just, quote, their fault for having given up their data to Google or Facebook, but that it's actually really, really hard in our current environment to protect your privacy on your own, and possibly we need a little more collective action.
Well, I look forward to your book, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Julia Angwin, who's an award-winning investigative journalist at The Wall Street Journal. She's the author of Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. In 2003, she was on a team of reporters at The Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. And in 2010, she led a team of reporters that chronicled the decline of online privacy in a series of articles titled What They Know, that won the Gerald Loeb Award. She has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the brazen Republican efforts at gerrymandering in the Virginia legislature. I'm looking for a side. I'm looking for